are listening to Regeneration Rising, a podcast from Kavira Coalition's new agrarian program that provides information and inspiration to agrarians beginning their journey in regenerative agriculture. Each episode will explore what it means to work in regenerative agriculture, how people come to choose this as their livelihood, and why it's important to them and our future. We hope this podcast provides a foundation of knowledge for future agrarians and land stewards so they can rise up and focus on a regenerative approach to community, relationships, and the land.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of Regeneration Rising. I'm Taylor Mulia. Before we jump into today's interview, I'd like to invite guests to a very cool webinar series we're hosting here at the New Agrarian Program with Olivia Tincani, and it's called Meat Business Fundamentals. Olivia invites a host of guest speakers to lend their wisdom about leadership and crafting values-based businesses, meat processing options for producers, and frameworks for starting a successful meat business that will support your farm, family, and community. This is a topic that I love, and I'm very excited for everything that Olivia and all these guest speakers have to share. You can register and find more information at kiviracoalition.org/business-series. Okay, on to today's episode. I am delighted to interview Katie McInnes. She is the co-owner and operator at the Dogs Run Farm near Clearwater, Manitoba, in Canada. We had an excellent conversation about her journey into agriculture as a person who grew up interested in acting, which I find really interesting. She talks about how she and her husband began their farm and ended up owning property, and what her life looks like now as a farmer, mother, and mentor in a sister program to the New Agrarian Program called the Young Agrarians. So thank you so much to Katie for joining us today, and thank you to all of our listeners for tuning in, and I hope you enjoy. Katie, thank you so much for joining us on the Regeneration Rising podcast.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me. What a great happenstance to meet you at the Regenerate Conference and yeah, get to now talk to you again.
Yeah, for sure. So tell the audience, where are you calling in from today?
I'm calling from our farm, which is near Clearwater, Manitoba in Canada. So to give a little bit of context, we're located quite close to the US-Canada border with North Dakota, where our farm is only 10 miles away from the border. We're considered southwestern Manitoba, but pretty far north for probably most of your listeners.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'd love to know more about your background. We ran into each other at the Regenerate Conference, like you said, and I was just taken by you and your husband have such a presence, and it would just seem like we had talked about the apprenticeship program and how much overlap between Young Agrarians and New Agrarian Program. And so I would just love to know a little bit more about your background. What did you study in school? What were you like when you were younger?
Sure, yes. So both Colin and I are first generation farmers, which is a term probably lots of listeners might be familiar with, but it just means that we didn't grow up in farming families. We didn't grow up on farms. We're both from a very urban context. We both grew up in the city of Winnipeg, which is the major city in our province. And a province is a bit like a state in Canada here. So yeah, we grew up in the major city of Winnipeg, which is around 700,000 to 800,000 people. It's the biggest city in for many, many hours in any direction. I grew up in sort of the city center. Colin grew up in the north end of the city and went to, you know, all of our schooling, high school, right up through university without being on farms or being in a farming family or farming context. Colin came from a bit of a different angle. He knew from, you know, a younger age, around, you know, 18, 19 years old, that this was a pursuit that he wanted to move in the direction of. So he took jobs and apprenticeships and things that would move him in the direction of learning more about farming. And I was not coming at it from that context. Growing up, I loved art and theater. And so that's what I studied and spent a lot of my time doing. And I studied photography. I studied theater. I studied film. And, you know, my dream, my ultimate dream was to become a really famous actor and get so rich that I could one day buy a ranch and live with the people who knew how to run the ranch. So that didn't end up working out for me. But I managed to come at it from a different angle when I met Colin, who was already sort of on this path and the visions that I had had for, you know, a life in the country and a life sort of with a relationship with the natural world and the seasons and animals sort of became clear when I met him. I said, aha, okay, so this is how it's going to work out. This is the direction it's going to go. I'd better learn some skills because I had really no applicable farm skills. Or I thought that at the time. I know better now to, you know, reevaluate the skills that I did have and how they have helped our business. But in terms of that point in my life, I had very few hard country skills.
Totally. So I have to ask, is this what's your sort of specialty in terms of acting? Did you want to do like musicals or films?
I was interested in film, certainly. My background was much more in theater, and I had, you know, attended pre-professional programs as a young person, as a teenager, and was, you know, working in that direction, hoping to go to the National Theater School, but then ended up instead pursuing art and went to the University of Manitoba and studied fine arts for 3 years and then came back and finished my honors year a few years later. So yeah, that's still an important part of my life. It's not one that gets as much attention, but actually just on Friday and Saturday, I had opening and closing night for a play, like a community theater play. So I still get to like have fun doing it every now and again. Opened and closed a play, only two nights, a very silly murder mystery, like just for fun kind of thing, community theater. So.
It was like a Agatha Christie kind of style?
Yeah, pretty much, like sort of making fun of Agatha Christie, but yeah, lots of fun. And it's sort of been a testament to being able to still exercise some different muscles, even while having the lifestyle of, you know, a farm that keeps us extremely busy and takes a lot of our energy. It's nice to have opportunities to flex some of those other things that are of interest too.
Yeah, totally. Okay, what's a good movie suggestion that you have for me? If we were having a movie night, what would you put on?
Oh my gosh. Oh, I only think of this because we're just talking about murder mysteries, but I really liked Knives Out. I think it came out a few years ago.
Oh my gosh, I loved that movie.
Did you know that? It was so good. Yes. I feel like maybe they've done another one or something. Maybe I've made that up. I'm like not a great pop culture reference point to investigate, but I really liked that one. That was fun.
Yeah, totally. I love that style, even though it's so predictable. Like you can literally point to a person and be like, that's who did it and have a chance of being right, you know?
So. Yeah, but it's kind of fun to sort of be involved in it in that way and feel like you're along for a bit of a ride, right? So.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. Well, cool. Tell me about how you got started in farming. So I saw on your website that you met Colin in 2012, and then it said that you started a farm in 2013, which is wild. Just tell me about that time. Like how did it come about? And yeah, what was it like?
It was wild. So yeah, the sort of background context was that Colin had been pursuing different farming opportunities. So through woofing, apprenticeships, the young agrarian programs, what didn't exist at that time. So it wasn't sort of that formal, but there was different opportunities. He had done a little bit of farming. You know, he'd done some woofing in Mexico and in Belize. And he picked up jobs doing carpentry. He was a fishing guide. He had all these sort of outdoor types of skills and was applying them to knowing that he wanted to farm. He was continuously, you know, looking for land access. And he completed his last apprenticeship that he did was at a farm called Harborside Farm, which is in Manitoba and is not far from where we are now, which I will reference back later. And he and I met shortly after he returned to the city from that apprenticeship. And he kind of didn't know what he was doing, where he was going. He knew he didn't want to be in the city. He wanted to get out. But that's the point that he and I met and started dating and became pretty clear to both of us pretty quickly that we were probably going to be together. And so we started getting serious about that question of sort of a pretty important question to ask a significant person in your life. Like, do you want a farm?
Absolutely. It's like getting married almost.
And because I sort of, the visions that I'd had as a younger person sort of felt clear all of a sudden after I met him, even though I was absolutely terrified. I said, yeah, let's go for it. And we started planning to find a farm. And as it would happen, that fall, we met sort of late winter. And by that fall, the next fall, we'd spent, you know, that summer living in the city together. But we came out and visited the mentors that he had apprenticed with the year before. And they had just acquired a piece of land that was adjacent to the home farm of Clint, one of the farmers. And it had like a shack on it. And it had some deer and some bush. And they didn't have particular plans for it other than this was sort of something they were, you know, had invested in and purchased. And because they knew Colin was looking for land, they sort of showed it to him. And I was with him at that, in that moment. And I had this feeling of like, oh, something's going to happen here. And I nudged him and I said, you should offer to do something with this place. And I mean, we'd only been dating for, you know, 6 months or something at that point. So I didn't want to insinuate that like, and you should invite me. But that conversation came pretty close on the heels. And we decided that by the following spring, we would move out to this shack.
And oh my gosh.
Which was, I look back and I am both proud of myself and I, you know, shake my head a little bit because it was pretty ambitious to say the
rustic.
Least. Yes, it was rustic for sure. And in that timeline, actually before we had even set eyes on that place, I, knowing that I was going to need to start to build up some hard skills, I applied for an apprenticeship at a farm also in southwestern Manitoba and was sort of lined up to arrive at that farm the next spring and spend that spring, summer, learning about growing bedding plants and looking after horses a little bit. And so, yeah, I was kind of lined up and then the land kind of lined up and we decided to do both at the same time. We moved in March and a snowstorm came the very next day and snowed us completely in. And we knocked down some walls and we just kind of got to work right away. And then 2 weeks after we had moved into this shack, I left to do my apprenticeship.
Wow.
And moved to Boise, Maine, Manitoba.
Wow. And how has the farm evolved since then? It's been 10 years.
10 years.
Yeah. I think I read online that there was an initial leased property and then there was a move at some point.
Yes. So the initial property was this property that belonged to Colin's former mentors.
Okay.
And we stayed there for about 18 months. So two farming seasons, two summer seasons that we spent at that place. And we kind of got started. It was pretty scrappy to start off and pretty small. Mm-hmm. It's like cute anecdote that when we left the city, moved to the farm, what we bought, we were searching. Kijiji is kind of like Craigslist, I think, like buy and sell online. And we found on Kijiji like a wheelbarrow and some like old wine, like plastic buckets. We bought some plastic buckets. We bought a wheelbarrow. We bought a used chainsaw and we bought some ropes, I think. We like moved to the country. And yeah, got our start. We bought a few, we bought some geese, we bought some chickens, we bought some pigs, we bought some sheep, small numbers of pretty much everything. And we decided that we would create these shares and they were pretty large shares of food. I think it was like a half lamb, a half a pig. I did a whole box of like preserves, like jams and jellies and pickles. We were going to do vegetables. It was all this stuff. It was, I think, a duck and a goose for each person. And I think we did something like 10 of those and made our friends and our family, our poor friends and family, who were the very first, you know, people who had to buy our food from us. And it was way too much. And it was probably too ambitious. But we, over that course of that season, we did raise those things. We ended up having, the garden was a bit of a fail. We had to buy vegetables from another friend, but we did raise all the animals that we planned to and delivered those shares to people who, you know, spread it amongst their own families. And that's how we did our very first year. And we've grown every year since then. And now we've grown quite a bit beyond that point.
Wow. Yeah.
And yeah, after that initial two seasons that we spent at the first farm, we came to our current location, which is our home now. And we own just the yard site. We own 12 acres here and we're farming at this point, as of this year, an additional about 200 acres that we're stewarding.
Holy smokes. So is that the 200 acres that you're leasing, are those connected to the land that you bought?
30 acres is directly connected. There's another 30 acres across the creek that we're trying to remediate into pasture. It's old cropland. And then just at the end of our mile road, so it's really not very far at all, but not contiguous to the property, is another 160 acres of grazing land for the cattle herd we bought this year.
Wow. That's quite an accomplishment. And what was the process of buying land like? Did you know that you wanted to live in that area, or did you guys shop around a lot? How did you kind of go about also like saving up for something like that?
In the time that we spent renting the sort of the shack, I guess I'll keep calling it, the opportunity to buy that would have been there, but it was too much land and too much of it was bush. Like, it just didn't make financial sense to try to make that a start. And the house wasn't really suitable for long-term living. So that sort of put us on the path of looking at other options. And Colin had already been looking around the province for something for a number of years. So he'd had some ideas of what he wanted. And we looked at a number of places together. We actually even had one neighbor at that rented land who offered us a small piece that had like a broken down house and a bunch of garbage on it. It was 7 acres. He said, "I'll sell it to you for $1 if you want to, you know, if this is your place, if this is the right place." People were really, you know, kind and welcoming to us. It wasn't the right place. It was sort of completely surrounded by canola fields. And we just knew that that wasn't going to be the home that we would be investing in. So we looked around for a long time, and we looked pretty seriously at a place at the other end of the province. And looking at that place sort of made us both feel so sad about leaving the community that we were in around here, that we ended up deciding to bid on the property that we're on now. Was actually a 160 acre parcel that came up for this sort of really strange phone auction. And we came, we looked at the house, we hiked the whole property. It was beautiful. It was on a creek. It was pretty dreamy. The house was needed a lot of work, but it was, you know, had some bones to it. And we decided we would try to bid on it, and we lost. We didn't get it. And we were kind of devastated because it just felt so right. It felt like the right place. I'm a sort of romantic and spiritual kind of person. And I had asked for a sign while we were here. You know, when we get to our right place, you know, send me a sign, send me an eagle, send me something. Oh. And while we were coming out of the hike on this piece of land, before we decided to bid on it, a golden eagle swooped right over my head just as Colin asked me what I was thinking. And what? Yeah, like it felt like it had to be right. And then we lost this auction. Like, what, how can this be? And just a few days after the auction closed and we had lost, we got a phone call, and it was from a guy. His name's Joe Gardner. And he called us up and said, "Hey, I won the auction, but all I want is to run my cattle on that land. I don't want that house and I don't want that yard site. Will you guys buy it from me?"
Wow.
Yes. And Joe's about the same age as me. And he knew us because, so the place that we are now and the place we were renting before are only about half an hour away. We share a lot of the same communities already, you know, these small towns that are all close by to each other. So we knew Joe, not really well, but he knew what we were doing and what we were trying to do. And he thought that that was of value and offered us sort of this chance to buy the house and buy the 12 acres that we would subdivide from the full quarter section property. And that's how we got our access to land. And it feels like, you know, in retrospect, it feels a little like a fairy tale or something. Like, yeah. I know part of it has to do with already being in the area and getting to know people and building trust. But I also know that we lucked out in a lot of ways, that the people were kind to us. And yeah, so I wish I had, you know, the ability to sort of give a magic wand for other young people who are looking for just their right spot. And it's not always, doesn't always work that way. But I do think that becoming part of the community that you want to live in, even if it means renting, even if it means you're not necessarily farming in that area, even if it just means getting a job, if there's a community that feels right to you, finding a way to earn trust and build yourself into that community, because there's so many small pieces of land that can change hands without ever coming on the real estate market.
Right. And right.
Yeah. So I think that that's maybe partly what helped us. But yeah, I feel extremely lucky.
Yeah. That's so, wow. That is so serendipitous that it was like, yeah, he called. I mean, I feel like that's like a dream. You're like, slap yourself in the face. You're like, wait, is this really happening? Did the guy that bought the property really call me just now?
When I answered that phone call, like, my mouth kind of dropped and I just sort of told them, okay, I'm going to talk to Colin. Like, I'll call you back right away on the phone. And I think it took us about 3 or 4 phone calls back and forth that very night over the course of like 10 or 15 minutes just calling each other back and forth till we had sort of this handshake idea agreement of what we were talking about, that we went from thinking we had nowhere to live because we knew we wanted to be off of that previous property to, yeah, basically agreeing to buy 12 acres and a rundown house.
You guys do a lot of stuff, very diversified farm. So tell me more about what you guys produce. What are your products that you sell?
So we have been raising pasture-raised pigs. We raise grass-fed lamb. We've been doing pasture-raised eggs as well as broilers. So pasture-raised chickens and pasture-raised turkeys. And we've just added us a cattle herd to our operation this year. So we haven't produced any beef as of yet because we're just getting started, but that's part of our long-term plans as well. And I also make handmade soap from the lard from our pigs.
Yeah, that's so cool. And how do you sell them? I saw you kind of have an online store, and then do you also do stuff locally? Do you do farmers markets? Yeah.
So yeah, our main sales are all direct sales. We do direct marketing. Most of our sales are in Winnipeg, which is the large city center here in Manitoba. We also have lots of customers in our local sort of community here. And we mostly do things through we do a monthly delivery. So we do pre-sales through our online store. People sort of, you know, reserve what they're looking for. We package it and give them the final price. They pay for it. We meet up in prearranged parking lot locations that we have permission to be in. We bring our truck and trailer, we set up, and we just distribute those orders. And we do some egg subscriptions as well, with distribution in a few different spots and occasional farmers markets. We used to do some more farmers markets, but it's something we're trying to move away from. We didn't do a farmer's market this summer, which mm-hmm. was actually really nice because Winnipeg is 2.5 hours away from our farm. So we're trying to really focus on this sort of more monthly style, which allows us to sort of really build up the sales over the month. And yeah, there are some occasional offhand markets. There's a cool music festival that happens right in our little town, and there's a farmer's market that happens along with that music festival. So that's always a big weekend for us that we know we want to do.
And so is it pretty seasonal? So you guys mostly have product in the summers, or do you try to time it so that you have meat processed all year round?
Yeah, we process all year round, and our poultry operation sort of takes one sort of trajectory, whereas the pork and the lamb and soon to be beef take a different year-long trajectory. The poultry, because we're so located so far north, we can really only raise pasture-raised meat chickens for a very short period of the year. We have about 4 months or so that we can have birds on pasture. We're also limited by some quota limitations when it comes to poultry in our province and in Canada. So we can only raise a certain number of chickens, both the broilers and the laying hens, which means that we really can't scale those operations. But scaling them in our climate is a pretty big challenge to begin with. So yeah, we can raise 1,000 broiler chickens, 300 laying hens, and 100 turkeys. That's what we are legally allowed to do without purchasing quota.
Wow, that's so interesting. And do you process all of your poultry, do you process that on farm, or does that go off with the, in the States, you know, you have to pretty much everything with four legs has to go off to USDA if you want to sell it. There's exceptions and funky stuff, but generally people process their poultry on farm. How does that work in Canada?
So for us, yeah, poultry again is in sort of a different category. You're right. Everything with four legs really does need to go through fully CFIA inspected facilities, which is great. And we use a facility that's about 45 minutes away from us. That's a small family run butcher shop, and we do everything through them. And we've got a really great relationship with them. Poultry is a little bit different. You're allowed to do what's called farm gate sales for poultry, which means that you don't have to have an inspected kill and process on poultry. However, there is only one fully inspected poultry processing plant in all of Manitoba. It's located about 3 hours away from us. So in the event that we do want to have poultry that could be sold to, say, a restaurant or at a farmer's market, it has to go through this one facility. Other than that, we can sell direct to consumers if it's been processed, I guess, on farm, but we have not processed on farm in years. We did that when we were just doing some, you know, ducks and geese and stuff like that. But since we've gotten into doing larger scale poultry operations, we do everything through, it's an uninspected, or it's not, it's a provincially inspected plant, but not federally inspected kill right. for the poultry. Mm-hmm. That's only 20 minutes away from us, which has been a really great, another great relationship to cultivate. Yeah. So we're allowed to sell those uninspected chickens direct to customers, but we have to store them in a different, we can't have them stored with our inspected meat, you know, all of our pork and our lamb and stuff like that. So there's a lot of different considerations. So the way that we've kind of worked that to make sense for our farm is doing the vast majority of our chickens as pre-sales with a certain pickup date. And people have to just, they order, you know, their 2 or 5 or 10 or 15 or even 50 chickens. They have to say, yes, I'm going to come and pick them up in this parking lot in on August 24th.
Wow.
And we move, we basically, from like the slaughter to in our customers' freezers is over the course of just a couple of days. So we're not really holding those animals. We're, you know, ideally paid for them right away, and we've moved them kind of out the door right away. It does mean a lot of logistics ahead of that in terms of the sales and marketing, but it seems to work well for us because then we're not handling or storing, you know, 1,000 different chickens.
Yeah.
We have been getting a smaller number of our chickens turned into cuts at the fully inspected location so that we can store and then sell those, you know, chicken breasts, chicken wings, that kind of stuff over the winter months.
Very cool. Very cool. Wow. It's pretty similar structure of a state inspected and then USDA inspected, but a lot of the folks in our state have quit on poultry. The margins are so small, and folks, I think there's a general hatred of poultry processing amongst a lot of butchers. I think it's like, yeah, just the, I think it's just doing that same thing so many times that there's just, I think chicken is the least favorite. So I feel like that's generally the direction the processing is going here. And it's so frustrating, but it's good to know you have some options. You don't have to do it on farm.
Yeah. It's still like, don't get me wrong, there are still issues and concerns. Like our, you know, poultry processor struggles to find staff every year. And so it, you know, often sounds like he says, I don't know, maybe not next year. And we have to plan these things a year in advance, right? So we don't always know where we're going to get these chickens processed. So I think for me personally, and Colin as well, we're both pretty interested in sort of moving our operation to concentrate more and more on the ruminants, especially, you know, their relationship with the landscape and the pasture. And that feels more fulfilling to me personally. Chickens are not, do not make my heart sing necessarily, but working with the cattle and the sheep feels like a different sort of energy that, yeah, we're both more interested in moving in that direction.
Yeah, I have the same experience that we raise chickens and turkeys here. And I also, I mean, there are turkeys on this landscape. Funny enough, we have a huge flock of wild turkeys that comes through. And so when we did raise turkeys, I really felt like, dang, this is a really ideal environment for them because even the wild ones are hanging out here. But I did kind of, from a grassland grazing perspective with poultry, I felt like we were hitting the land a little bit too hard. It can happen really quickly with that hot nitrogen heavy manure. And so I felt like from a grazing perspective, yeah, it was just so much easier to work with sheep.
I mean, they're tropical birds that are not, you know, necessarily adapted to a grassland ecosystem.
Yeah.
We're trying to, I mean, we're always trying to, you know, make something, find the middle ground between, you know, profitability and species appropriateness and how everything, you know, should be raised and in relationship with the land. And it's a tricky one. I mean, we've been domesticating animals for thousands and thousands of years, but the systems are not perfect. And I have a lot of thoughts in terms of the relationship between us and animals and the earth and these ideas of what's natural and what's appropriate. And it's sort of all still a work in progress.
Mm-hmm. You know, that kind of leads me to my next question. What does it feel like the biggest strengths of the operation are? And what does it feel like? It sounds like the poultry might be one of these weaknesses, but yeah, what are the weaknesses that you're like, ooh, we could probably trim that, or I don't love that, or we got to get better at that system? Yeah.
I think certainly in the last number of years, and just for me personally, especially even just from a logistics point of view, the poultry take the most of my logistical and marketing organizational capacity and sort of mm-hmm. customer relation capacity, because they're sort of the most confusing thing that we grow, that we say we're growing these things, but they're not ready yet, but you have to say you'll get them, and you have to only come at this time, and we have to get them processed here, and has to only be done this way. And if you don't show up, you're putting me in trouble.
And this is all like, might I remind you, for like chicken. Like this is all, it's so funny to me. It's like, it feels like something like way more important than chicken, but it's like, that's what we have to do, you know?
And yeah, I end up feeling kind of like a crazy person when I'm, you know, emailing people for the third time about their chickens or whatever. But yes, it's, I've, yeah, and gone through sort of the numbers, and certainly the chicken operation, if we were able to scale it, it probably could become even more profitable. It's like pretty razor thin at this point, but we're not able to scale it. So it just, it's a part of the operation that just doesn't feel like it makes a lot of sense to invest more time and money or money or energy into making more efficient when we're not even able to scale it. So yeah, I think that there's something that could certainly potentially be trimmed there, but that's probably a couple of years off for us until we can continue to grow the cattle and sheep operation. And those two pieces feel like great pieces for us. I think we've built a really great relationship with customers, especially a lot of lamb lovers, which, you know, lamb is kind of one of those things, either you're interested or you're not, or you think you're not. And we've, I think, gained a pretty good reputation for making some really good lamb. And I'm hoping we can do the same thing for beef. And our eggs as well seems to be like a really great use of our time and efforts. Unfortunately, I wish we could scale that one a little bit more too, but unfortunately we're at our quota limitation, our quota exemption limitation with our 300 hens. And I mean, yeah, you're asking about strengths and weaknesses. And I think I'd have to say that, you know, outside of the sort of directly thinking of in enterprise terms, that I think one of our strengths is our honesty and transparency. That's something that we work really hard to be with our customers, to explain what we're doing and why we're doing things and what our sort of vulnerabilities are and what's working well for us. And I think we've built a lot of trust with our customers, and even just our social media following, and we have a really great group of people cheering us on. Even if they're not customers, we've got people who seem to really want to support us in whatever way they can. And I think that that's been a really rewarding part of being in business. And in terms of weaknesses, I think that I know for myself personally, I have worked over years and continue to work on not worrying about the worst all the time and anticipating the worst. I tend to be, between Colin and I, like, he's much more likely to be the sort of innovator and ideas maker. And I'm much more the, okay, let me think of everything that can go wrong so that I can be prepared for when it does. Yeah. So we've had to find ways to communicate those different styles and balance each other out. And I think, you know, we have chosen each other for a reason, but finding ways to not have that be the very first reaction to new thoughts and ideas and change on the farm, because I mean, things change all the time and change continuously. And we are dealing with, you know, a changing world every year, and climate change. And yeah, adaptability is pretty important. So
that's a great answer. Yeah. I feel like that is something that I learned too, is like, you have this illusion that it's going to be some stable situation, some stable like operation that you feel good about, and it's just going to continue on. And then I learned quickly that it is a different game every single season. Like, there is something new about every single year, especially with water. In, I'm sure your climate is no different, that it's just every year we're like, what's it going to be? We're either going to be running 100 sheep or nothing.
Well, being at the conference just a couple weeks ago in Santa Fe, and hearing all the different speakers and just talking to different people who were attending, the amount that farmers and ranchers in your area are having to consider water and the brittleness, like it put things in perspective for me. I mean, we've been farming in drought almost most of my 10 years of farming. The last 7 years have been the worst. This year was terrible, and it's been really challenging. But then, you know, I'm given some perspective on ways that people are adapting and doing their best to conserve water in places in the world, like in New Mexico. And that's, yeah, been opening and a good reminder to just be thankful for what we do have going for us, you know, in our different environments.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. I know. I've never been up that far. I've never been to that part of the world, but it's always, yeah, I'm like trying to imagine, what is Manitoba like? Is it pretty, you guys are a part of the Great Plains?
Yeah. So as I mentioned earlier, we're in southwestern Manitoba, which is we're in Treaty One territory. It's traditionally the lands of the Anishinaabe, the Cree, the Métis people, and the Dakota. And it's been grassland for, you know, the better part of its history. And we're in areas that include a bit of aspen parkland. So there's a little bit of rolling hills and valleys in our area with oak and poplar and aspen trees, cottonwoods, that kind of thing. Our part of Canada has a lot of lakes. I think they call Minnesota the land of like 1,000 lakes or something. Well, Manitoba has 100,000 lakes.
Okay. All right. We get it. No, I'm just kidding.
And the northern part of the province is boreal forest and turning to tundra. So, I mean, we're talking about a huge, vast distance, but we're down in the southwest corner. So we are in traditionally what would be grassland. Most of the land has been put into crop agriculture. And the vast majority of that is like wheat, canola, soybeans, corn, barley, oats, those sorts of crops. There's still hayland and pasture land, but that's pretty much anywhere that could be used more profitably as cropland is. The cattle ranches and the cow-calf operations are really shrinking to the marginal land and to the valleys and to a lot more smaller pieces. And we're witnessing that change just even in our time out here that we've been in this area and as young farmers. So yeah, that gives a little bit of context where we still have, you know, there's still topsoil. There's a lot of water that does run. We deal with runoff issues and there's flooding that happens in the province most years. You know, we have pretty major flood watch situations in the Red River Valley. We're in a different river valley where things are not quite as dire, but yeah, water management is definitely an issue. And yeah, we've been experiencing drought, so way less rainfall in the last number of years. And that's been affecting a lot of farmers' livelihoods and planning. And certainly this year and 2021 was, I mean, probably most people would recognize that was sort of a huge North America-wide drought. Whereas the drought that we experienced was very, very, very isolated, like different. Our neighbor could get an inch of rain and we'd get nothing. I think we only got, in the growing season, we got about 3 inches of rain, I think, this year.
My gosh. Whoa.
Yeah, it was super bad.
Wow.
And then moisture came this fall and the pastures bounced back and we've had this weird sort of mild fall and there's green grass on the ground right now. It's pretty bizarre.
Whoa. So you guys are having a growing season, but like way later, all these cool season grasses are like, I'm here.
I mean, we're just really happy. The sheep are still out on pasture. The cattle are still out on pasture. We're getting sort of the last of it. That field, like that, you know, had been part of the plan anyway, but in July this year, there was literally nothing growing and we didn't know what we were going to be able to do, you know, into the fall and early winter. So
yeah, for sure. Well, thank you. Yeah, that helps a lot. I feel like and realizing I need to go to Canada more. I really don't know much.
And I have to mention, of course, because I wouldn't be due diligence without saying it gets very, very cold here in the winter. And we deal with temperatures like minus 40 degrees, which is the same at Celsius as it is at Fahrenheit. Yeah, crazy windstorms and lots of snow and all those things happen all winter long.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Wow. I feel like this is a good segue into Canada, your amazing program that you are a part of, Young Agrarians. I'm pretty sure this predates me being a part of NAP working here, but I think that we are kind of like cousins, like we kind of help each other out sometimes. And so like the formation of your program happened alongside our program. So it's really cool to see it blossoming. So you've been in it for 3 years now. Tell us about what it's like to be a mentor in the Young Agrarians Apprenticeship Program.
Yeah, that's my sort of understanding too. They're sort of like, sister programs. And there's been some overlap and inspiration between the two. So yeah, Young Agrarians has been running a mentorship program across the prairies. So that's Manitoba, Saskatchewan, and Alberta for the last 3 years. And we've been participating as a mentor host farm for the last 3 years. And we got involved because we had connections who were part of the Young Agrarians organization and staff. And they sort of tapped us and said, look, we're going to start doing this mentorship program. Is this something you'd be interested in? We hadn't had any employees at that point, and we'd just done everything, the two of us, and we were ready at 3 years ago to really start to look at growing the farm. I was also expecting my first, our child. So we knew we were definitely going to need some more hands around. And yeah, so we agreed to join in. And it's been just such a wonderful experience and has really shaped our whole lives, really, because of the way that we've approached it as something quite immersive. The way that we've designed our personal, you know, apprenticeship on our farm is that the apprentice is living and working with us for 6 to 7 months and living in our home. We're eating all our meals together. We are, you know, showing them all parts of our business and all aspects of what we're doing and how we're raising animals on the farm. We've created relationships with our three apprentices that we've had through the program that are like family and are still like family.
I love this like transition. I've just interviewed somebody else that was just at that transition of like wise old mentor, but you are very wise. Like you have this incredibly usable experience for these young people and you can speak their language. You can really connect with them in a really interesting way. And so yeah, tell me about what surprised you the most about mentorship.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think for us, a big part of the reason we wanted to be involved was because both Colin and I had experienced mentorship as new first generation, you know, not from farm family farmers. And it was just so important to us that we were able to offer that once we felt our feet were under us. And so when the timing did feel right, we sort of opened our home and our farm up to that opportunity. I mean, I don't know if I would say that it's surprising because it was sort of, you know, what I hoped and how I approached it and designed it, but just how important these individuals have become to us and are like family. And, you know, our apprentice from our first year who was from Manitoba, I mean, she still comes and helps out and like hangs out and we bake Christmas cookies together every year. And we're like family. And our apprentice for this year just left today. Catherine had a wonderful season here and we were so thankful to get to work together all summer long. And our apprentice, Victoria, from last year, went on and did another grazing, can't remember the title of the job, but she got like a farming job immediately after wow. leaving our place and was ranching in Quebec, which it's just such a huge compliment. I think I take it as this like huge compliment when the people who have come through with us and have lived with us and been through the intense growing and farming season still want to farm and still want to talk to us after. I feel like I've done something right in the world. And our mentorship and relationship with each of these people continues to this day. And it's so special. And yeah, I don't think I could have envisioned that, you know, even 3 years later that my mentee would still want to hang out with me.
Yeah, that's so cool. Yeah. And it just kind of too, I think farming can sometimes be really isolating. You're spending a lot of time in your own home and your own land. And so, yeah, it feels like there are these really meaningful connections that, yeah. And you say something about the design of it, sort of what was your intention? Like, how did you design this program to be successful? Like, did you specifically say like, we're going to do this thing? What was the design process like?
For the interview process that the apprentices go through the Young Agrarians program, you know, there was an opportunity to sort of set up the questions, the kinds of questions we knew we wanted to ask and our own apprenticeship outline and the sort of the, you know, application package, all those things to start to just really show somebody even before accepting an apprenticeship, what it was that we're talking about, you know? And so a lot of the questions had way less to do with what's your farming experience and what are your power tool experience and what do you know about plants and those kinds of things. That was not nearly as important to us as how do you feel about cooking for a group? How do you feel about living with kids? Mm-hmm. How do you feel about, you know, talking through communication issues? How do you feel about living with us together? Like, is this what the relationship that's going to work? It's kind of like interviewing a roommate. And we wanted the people who we were interviewing and subsequent apprentices to feel like they could interview us back, right? So we really welcomed a lot of questions. We welcomed a lot of, you know, specifics about what it kind of looked like. And yeah, for me personally, when we were doing our first round of interviews, I was like very pregnant and looking and knowing that, you know, somebody was going to be, provided we had made a match with somebody, someone was going to be coming to our farm when our kid was like 6 weeks old. And oh my that gosh. Was going to be really intense. And so it had to be the right person. And it couldn't just be anybody on both ends, right? It had to be somebody who was willing to see us in that really vulnerable place in our life, and somebody that we were willing to share our space with and work alongside and mentor, you know, through that really pretty intense time. And it just turned out that we did get pretty much the perfect fit, I think, and felt really lucky for that.
Yeah. Tell me more about being a mom and farming. Like, what are some ways that you've learned to balance things?
It's certainly an aspect I talk a lot about with, you know, anyone who'll listen, but the apprentices that we've had so far, for sure, it comes up as they've got front row seats to watching our parenting and the struggle of, yeah, trying to get things done in a day and attend to all the different needs. And also we've been so lucky that each of those people has become like a member of the family and is like a big sister, auntie, cousin person to our son, and is by design too. That's, you know, that's sort of the big hope that relationship comes out of it as well. And yeah, in terms of, I mean, being a parent and farming, I think it's probably, you know, the thing that occurs to me the most is the same for somebody who's not farming. And it's the hardest thing is having a support network. And it's such a simple thing to say, but it's such a complicated and difficult and really often very unattainable thing for new parents, especially farming parents, to find enough. Because just like the farm is sort of this bottomless pit of needs, a kid is a bottomless pit of needs as well. And there is no such thing as like enough support. You know, I've never said to a grandparent or something like, no, we don't need you. Yeah, we've just never really said to somebody that we don't need, you know, another day of help or another set of hands. So we have childcare, like he goes to daycare a couple of days a week. My mom, who ended up, she and my stepdad moved to a town half an hour away from us, which is pretty amazing, comes a couple mornings a week. Colin's mom bought a little house to be her grandma cabin in our teeny little town.
So grandma cabin.
It's amazing. I don't know how, again, we just sort of got, I guess it's extremely lucky, or there's something that we've done to bring people to us, and that our apprentices have each, they've pitched in and love our kid as much as we do. Like we've lucked out in that way totally. But I still don't feel that balance has been achieved. It's a balance I'm still looking for. I think for me, the balance has been, or the imbalance has been actually just time outside on the land has been the big sacrifice, because somebody typically has to be with the kiddo, and Colin's skills are much more broadly applicable to the outside work on the farm, whereas mine are much more broadly applicable to the behind the scenes organizational, marketing, administrative tasks that can get done while you're, you know, holding a baby, and can kind of you can answer an email between playing trains and those kinds of stuff. So that balance for me is what has been the most notable aspect that I'd like to, my goal for next season is to try and find a bit more balance there.
In terms of your apprentices, it's so interesting that you mentioned the fact that the hard skills are actually not as important as the softer skills. And so I'd love to hear, like, in your opinion, after you've seen a couple of these apprentices come through, sort of what's one skill that you think that apprentices overall could use some work on? And I actually think I want to ask you about a soft skill in particular.
It's something, it kind of goes hand in hand for also a skill that the mentor has to have as well, because it's unfair to, because it's a mentorship, it's not just a job, right? This is a mentorship situation. Everything is hand in hand with the mentor and mentee. Like there isn't just this agreement of you do your job and I'll do my job. Everything has to have this overlap. People who are interested in trying something like an apprenticeship are often people who are pretty good at the things that they try to do when they try something new. You know, somebody who's willing to take that much of a step and a risk has probably been pretty good at a lot of the new things that they try. And so I think a good skill is to allow yourself the grace to not be so good at everything. Give yourself permission to fail and to be learning and to not pick it up exactly. You know, I think we get these romantic ideas in our head, myself certainly, that you're just going to go out there and be, you know, roping cattle on your first try or doing everything perfectly right away because you're just so suited to this beautiful life. It's a skill. It is a skill that needs exercising to have that sort of both humility and grace with yourself to allow yourself to to fail and mess up sometimes, because that's exactly how you're going to learn these new skills. And of course, that goes hand in hand with the mentor needing the skill to remember that they're mentoring and that they need to allow for that learning opportunity to take place, even if it's challenging to have to walk through things slower and go through things again and all those things that mentorship takes that is not the same as just having a staff person.
What are some visions that you have for the future?
As I've discussed a little bit, I think if we're able to continue to grow the sheep and the cattle in particular, that's sort of what we're talking about right now as our goals. A lot of that is dependent on land access, of course, but we're working with our own mentors, having through the Young Agrarians program, we actually became mentees in the Business Mentorship Network as we were beginning our cattle herd. And we signed on with our own mentor, who we were already kind of bringing to the table anyway, because we were in some discussions about buying cattle and renting land from them. Their names are Don and Diane Guilford of Guilford Hereford Ranch, and they have been just the right people for us to start learning about the cattle business from. And that's been a really great experience to learn from some seasoned ranchers while we get our start. And so there could be opportunities in the future to grow through them, I hope. Yeah, I hope our farm can be something bigger than just the two of us. Like, I would love to be able to support more, you know, full-time year-long staff or people who are interested in being rural and living in this area. I hope that our farm can get to a point where it's not just us two and our ideas and our goals and dreams, that it can get bigger than that. I don't always know what that looks like, but I'm pretty open to the possibilities.
My final question is, if you could give advice to yourself 10 years ago, which is very convenient in terms of what was happening 10 years ago, what might that be?
I think if I was giving advice to my younger self, I think in particular with farming, that I would probably tell myself to reevaluate what you think success means. And I think, you know, I don't know if it's just personally or culturally that we tend to sort of define success as anything that you say you're going to do, and then you do it forever and you never stop and you never change. And you get really, you become really good at it and nothing ever changes and you do that forever. That, you know, if you stop raising a certain type of livestock, or if you change the way that you're running your farm, that maybe you must have failed something. And I think that that's just something I would want to reevaluate in my own mind, that just acquiring those skills and having those experiences is a success in and of itself, not necessarily just getting so good at something and then doing it forever is the definition of success.
I love that. And okay, Katie, what's the best way for people to find more information about your farm?
We've got a website as well as Instagram. We're called The Dogs Run Farm, and we're near Clearwater, Manitoba. The Instagram is just The Dogs Run Farm, and that's where I'm most active in terms of information about the farm and just what's going on. And it's a great place for people to come say hello. If you do, give me a little DM and say you heard the podcast and want to say hi.
That sounds great. And the Young Agrarians program, what's the timeline for that? So when do applications open for next season?
For next season, applications have historically opened, I think, December or January, and then they usually close January 31st, and then often there's a bit more of a grace period into February. And most apprenticeships start typically May. We like to start right at the end of April just to get the ball rolling, and we run all the way till October, November. And some apprenticeships, especially on more of the veggie farms and stuff, are for shorter durations, usually into September. But yeah, there's a huge variety of farms that are offering apprenticeships. So yeah, if you're listening from Canada or interested in looking at the Canadian apprenticeships, check it out, Young Agrarians.
Thank you so much, Katie. And just thank you so much again for jumping on this podcast. I just met you and was like, I want to talk to you more.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me. It's been great. And like, just getting a chance to keep the door open between the two organizations and our two parts of the world is, I think, just wonderful.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Katie. And we'll link to the Young Agrarians program in the show notes so people can find that. But in the meantime, hope you get some nice rest this winter and are able to stay warm in that negative 40 up there.
Thanks, Taylor. I appreciate it. And you too.
Thank you so much for tuning in. If you'd like to connect to the broader Kivir community of ranchers, farmers, conservation and government agency professionals, educators, nature nerds, curious consumers, and more, we're excited to have you. Our website is kivircoalition.org, and in the upper right, click on Get E-News to sign up for our newsletter, where we share happenings and events, learning opportunities, job postings, and more. Also, if you're enjoying this podcast, please leave us a review and a rating. It really will help other people find us and maybe even find their next step in regenerative agriculture. Thanks so much, and see you next time.
This podcast was produced by Kivira Coalition in our quest to support resilience on working lands. Learn more about our work and how you can support regenerative agriculture and solutions to climate change at kivircoalition.org. This episode was edited and engineered by Caleb Wenzel-Fisher. A Folk Story, our theme music, was made by Alex Cristoforetti, and we're grateful for our guests who take time out of their busy lives to share their experiences with us.